Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump emerge as winners of most of yesterday's primary elections. Does this mean we can predict the GOP and Democratic nominees? We'll discuss this hour on Politics Day. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Emily Woodbury. I'm joined this hour by Kedron Bardwell of Simpson College and Chris Larimer with the University of Northern Iowa. We'll talk about what yesterday's results mean for the five presidential candidates left in the race and what's to come with the remaining primaries in Indiana, Nebraska, and Kentucky. We hope to hear from you as well. How do you see the results of yesterday's primaries? Conversation after this news. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day today, and we'll be talking about the results of yesterday's primaries, the ongoing politics of the presidential election, and later on in the program, we'll talk about Governor Branstad's decision to not endorse a candidate in the Republican primary race between incumbent U.S. Representative Steve King and his challenger, State Senator Rick Bertrand. With me today are Kedron Bardwell. He's an associate professor of political science at Simpson College. Hi, Kedron.
Hi, good to be with you.
Yeah, you too. And Chris Larimer, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa. Hi, Chris.
Hello, thanks.
So, the results from yesterday's primaries. Hillary Clinton won four out of five of yesterday's primaries. Bernie Sanders won Rhode Island. And here's what she had to say, her statement, after the results came in.
Whether you support Senator Sanders or you support me, there's much more that unites us than divides us.
And including in her statement to Bernie Sanders supporters, she also aimed her statement at Donald Trump.
We're going to imagine a tomorrow where hard work is honored, families are supported, and where love trumps hate.
So let's take on that first statement, that idea of unifying the Democratic Party. Kedron, can Clinton unify the party? How are we looking as far as Bernie Sanders supporters?
Well, I think the Democratic side, they have fewer concerns about this. I think if you listen to that language, you know, there's much more that unites us than divides us. She's taken advantage of the fact that she sees that opening within the Republican Party essentially to knock them as not even having their own act together. I think that the Sanders supporters, for the most part, I think will stick with Hillary. The issues that Sanders cares about, it's not as if the Democratic Party has changed their positions on income inequality or other issues that he cares about. And he's not so much a personality candidate like Trump, who I think is driven by persona as much as anything else. I think he really is an issue candidate. Hillary Clinton isn't necessarily the best candidate, for example, to speak against Wall Street and some of the other concerns that Bernie Sanders has had. But I think the supporters will stick with the Democrats in the general election.
And Clinton's now ahead where Barack Obama was in 2008 when he was running against Hillary in terms of delegates and superdelegates. What do you think this says about her chances in the general election?
Well, I think that it's actually – it gives her a little more time to kind of get things together while the Republicans are worried about what might happen at a possible convention. It allows her to move into general election mode. This also allows her to be spending resources, assuming that Bernie might drop out in the next several weeks. That allows her to spend resources already targeting general election electorates with advertising, et cetera, and not have to worry so much about spending that in her own contest.
We're talking about politics today on River to River, and we want to hear from you. Do you agree that Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have more uniting them than dividing them? And how do you see the results of yesterday's primaries? You can give us a call at 866-780-9100, email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or tweet us at IPRTalk. And if you're a Cruz or Kasich fan, how do you feel about their decision to team up against Donald Trump? It didn't work last night on the East Coast, but will it work in Indiana, Nebraska, West Virginia, and Kentucky? Again, the number to call is 866-780-9100. Chris, how did you see yesterday's results on the Democratic side? Was it something that surprised you, or were you mostly expecting Hillary Clinton to sweep the Northeast?
I think mostly expecting what happened to that happened. You know, I think it's not particularly surprising that Rhode Island was the one state that Bernie Sanders was able to get. That was the one state that was open in the sense that independents could participate in that primary. And so he has done a little bit better in states where it is open to independents participating. But, you know, to Kendren's point and your question, I think, you know, is exactly right. For Clinton, she's wanted to do two things, right? She wants to pivot to the general election and be able to focus on the general election, and she's trying to heal any sort of wound she has with younger voters. I mean, that's been the consistent result throughout the primary process, is that among that younger demographic, she trails Sanders by, you know, 50, 60 points in some cases in some of those states. And so the sooner she can start pivoting toward the general election, the sooner she can start to try to make amends with that younger electorate is going to be to her benefit. And there's still time to do that. As you said, you know, she's actually ahead of where, you know, Obama was in 2008 in their battle. So she has a legitimate argument to say that we need to start thinking about the party. We need to start thinking about November. It's just she has to do it in sort of a delicate way, so that not only are those younger voters, you know, so they're not turned off in a way that they're not going to show up in November. I mean, I think that's one of the biggest fears for the Clinton campaign right now, is to lose those younger voters to abstention, that they just simply don't show up in November.
Mm-hmm. Well, Kedren, what do you think is the future of the Sanders movement? Do you think that someone will step up and rally that crowd? Do you think Hillary can be that person?
I think she can. You've seen her moving in the direction of some of the policies that Sanders has supported. She's actually become pretty outspoken about raising the minimum wage and has talked about it in ways that I think appeal to those groups. You mentioned the youth vote, and that's an interesting thing to kind of bring in here too, because it reached its peak in 2008 at almost 50% of the vote. 18 to 29-year-olds actually turning out to vote, but it sank by about 6 or 7 points in 2012. And so what she's trying to capture is this enthusiasm that tends to drive the young people out to vote. And it's yet to be seen whether she can do that effectively. I think having, for example, the position she does on women's issues, health issues, helps her a little bit. I think bringing her husband out on the campaign trail also helps, and she should be able to pull that together.
Mm-hmm. As I mentioned, Bernie Sanders took Rhode Island last night in the primaries, but he lost the other ones, though he's saying he's going to stay in the race until the convention.
This campaign is not just about electing a president. It is about transforming our nation.
Do you think that is Sanders kind of, in a way, gently, you know, stepping a little bit away and kind of recognizing where he's at in the election, Kedren?
Yeah, I think, as I said, he's an issue candidate. And so I think when we've seen issue candidates in the past that have, you know, two or three issues they really care about, they want to get it discussed on the national stage. They want to get it more emphasized in the party platform, for example. I think that the thing that will determine kind of how he bows out is if he feels that the party's really listening and that Clinton is listening. Now, he may in his mind have this idea, and I know he's talked about it, that he can still win a few more states and maybe change the mind of some of those Democratic superdelegates, those elected officials, hundreds of them, that seem to be lining up behind Clinton. Now, I think that's not necessarily going to happen, but I think he still may have in his mind that this is doable. Sometimes it's hard to convince candidates that so to speak, all is lost and that they should pack it in.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Dwayne is calling in from Marshalltown. Hi, Dwayne.
Hello.
So you're a Bernie Sanders supporter?
I was a Bernie Sanders supporter when he was 3%.
Okay. And how are you taking in the results of last night's primaries? Are you still thinking he has a chance in the general election?
Well, what I think, and I've thought this all along, is that I want Bernie to stay a senator because he has more power then. And I think while like I said, when we had the 1960, I'm old, when we had the 1968 elections, or riots, I mean, in Chicago, my opinion was that since then we've never had a Democrat run. We've had conservative Republicans running, and I voted for Clinton as a conservative Republican, not as a Democrat, and I believe his wife's the same way. However, what we've watched now since I've been watching Bernie, he's got her to almost agree with everything he wants. And I think she's got the ego, and she's the kind of person that is wishy-washy enough that she's got to have a – she wants his presidential – she wants it bad, and she wants to go out looking good. And as a result of that, I think Bernie he is more useful out in the public for the next 8 years, keeping the people going at the local level. And she will go along with anything. She's got enough of the important things right now. And anything he passes, she's going to agree with and not veto. So I think – and another thing is that the presidency, just like in the case of Obama, when you go in there, you have to be a president. And that takes a lot of time and wastes a lot of energy. And Bernie is much more valuable where he is right now in the Senate, making the laws for her to put in. So I hope she gets – that's my opinion.
All right. Thanks for your call, Dwayne. So, Chris, do you kind of see that Bernie Sanders has kind of done his job moving the conversation so that, you know, Hillary Clinton can move more towards the left? Do you see that?
I think right now you can make that argument that he's shifting the conversation. The question is, how long will that affect the party past the convention? I mean, will this stay with the party? Will they adopt some of these into the platform, and they may do that in a way to appeal to Sanders supporters. But you know, the challenge, as Kendra said, sometimes it's hard to convince a candidate that it's just mathematically not possible. And for Sanders, that's where we are. Mathematically, it's a very difficult, if not impossible, road ahead. The hard part I imagine for the Sanders campaign is that every single poll that they see shows that Bernie Sanders is more likable than Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders is more honest and trustworthy than Hillary Clinton among all adults when you're doing national samples. And so, you know, there may be a sense, well, everybody seems to like our guy, but he's just not winning. Shouldn't he stay in if this is the candidate that people like? And that's a hard argument to make. But, you know, as Dwayne was mentioning, you know, there have been moderate Democrats. You know, you think about Bill Clinton, and he was about triangulation when he came into office. And, you know, as he was chair of the Democratic Leadership Council, which was this more moderate council for governors. But Obama was this transformational figure, right? He was supposed to be that person who would transform the party, transform the country. But once you get into governing, it becomes more difficult. And so I actually kind of question how effective Bernie Sanders can be in the United States Senate. I mean, that's a place where things slow down to a glacial pace, and it is very, very difficult to get anything done. So I don't know that he can be more effective as a senator. I think right now may be his best shot if he wants to change the party and change people's thinking. It may be right now.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to throw this idea to you both. Donald Trump tweeted the other day that Bernie Sanders has been treated terribly by the Democrats. This is in Trump's tweet, both with delegates and otherwise. He should show them and run as an independent. Do you see this as very likely, Kedren?
I don't actually, but this is smart politics by Trump here. Essentially, when you see an opening, go for it. You're playing on that history that we have with third-party candidates, where essentially, call it the Nader effect, perhaps. But when third-party candidates get into the race, they actually, number one, don't win, and number two, end up throwing the race to the candidate that they like the least. So certainly makes smart political sense for Trump to throw the idea out there or try to encourage it, especially Bernie Sanders supporters, to encourage the idea that he should continue on and pull those few percent away from Clinton if he ran as an independent, and then give Trump a real shot in the general election.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm curious, Chris, you take a look at voting populations in your work, and, you know, a lot of Sanders supporters have been frustrated by the process and by the fact that there are a lot of closed primaries, independents can't participate because they're not registered Democrats or Republicans. Do you think this year, with so much turmoil and so much attention on that, that we're going to end up looking at and possibly changing how we run our primaries?
There may be a conversation about that, but I mean, you know, that's a hard process to change, and because you have to have such widespread agreement within the party, and you may see some tweaks here and there, but you know, one of Bernie Sanders' main arguments is about income inequality in the United States, and I forget where I saw it, but it was on Twitter somewhere. Someone had pulled, or this morning, I think on NPR, they had pulled a graph of states with. And measured those states in terms of income inequality, and actually Hillary Clinton's winning in states with the highest amount of income inequality. So, you know, the idea that Sanders is somehow losing out because of the system, there may be other elements here where he's losing in places where he should be winning. It's just that his message is not coming through. We know that he's generating enthusiasm, but you know that's not necessarily always translated into votes in the way we see it. So I don't know that you're going to actually see a change in the process, right? It's proportional for the Democratic Party. You may see some adjustments with superdelegates. That seems to be the big frustration right now, that we have these superdelegates, these unelected people who are really not bound to any candidate, and then Hillary Clinton has such an enormous advantage there. But even among just pledged delegates, as was mentioned earlier, you know, Hillary Clinton is doing better than Obama was against Hillary Clinton in 2008. So I think it's a hard argument to make that it's all about the process. I think in some cases it's just the candidate. I mean, there have been reports earlier in this campaign cycle from people who work on the Sanders campaign that he should have gone negative sooner, that it was actually a tactical error that he didn't attack Hillary Clinton sooner, and she was able to build this large lead early on in the campaign, and it's just been hard to overcome since.
It's Politics Day on River to River. I'm joined by political analyst Kedron Bardwell and Chris Larimer. You can join our conversation by tweeting us at IPR Talk, emailing rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org, or by calling 866-780-9100. I'd like to move a bit to the GOP side. Donald Trump, as we mentioned at the beginning, won all 5 primaries yesterday: Connecticut, Maryland, Delaware, Pennsylvania, and Rhode Island. He also looked toward the general election and took aim at Hillary Clinton.
Well, I think the only card she has is the woman's card. She's got nothing else going. I don't think she'd get 5% of the vote. The only thing she's got going is the woman's card. And the beautiful thing is, women don't like her, okay? And look how well I did with women tonight, okay?
So thoughts on that, Kedron? How do you take that statement from Donald Trump? He's looking towards the general election.
Well, the famous visual that accompanied that statement was Mary Pat Christie basically rolling her eyes in the background as Trump said that, which I thought was interesting. I mean, it strikes me as a particularly sexist statement, essentially diminishing, you know, her ability as a person and saying the only reason she's even got the support that she's had is playing the gender card. You know, Trump is doing fine, I think, and if he's on track and thinking about winning this nomination, and he feels like he's doing what he needs to do, and why change his rhetoric in winning the nomination? But he's digging himself a pretty huge hole for the general election, assuming he's the candidate, among Hispanics, among other minorities, among the youth vote, among the female vote, and not just in ways that are only related to issues. I think just in terms of his personality and the way he talks about them, it's demeaning to some of those groups, and I think that's a harder hole to dig yourself out of than just, you know, triangulating or spinning an issue a different way. It's that they fundamentally just don't like him. And so you saw Clinton come back and say, well, you know, if fighting for health care and family leave and equal pay is playing the gender card, deal me in. And she in that way is really taking advantage of the advantage I think she already would have against Trump with women voters.
Well, I think it's really interesting to see how she responds to Trump. And if he was the Republican nominee, we're going to see it a lot more. And I wonder if we had a Clinton v. Trump general election, you know, how will their styles go in debates and in advertising? How do you think Clinton's very policy-focused debate style will clash with Trump's kind of one-liners and personal attacks? Chris?
Well, I guess my concern is that, you know, we're at a point where it's a really interesting paradox. I mean, Trump and Clinton have essentially mathematically eliminated their competition, but they're also the two candidates who are mathematically more unpopular than their competition. And so, you know, my concern going forward is that this is not going to be an election in the fall that's going to energize a lot of people to come out and participate, to come out and vote, because you have the two most unpopular candidates who are the two nominees. And so, those debates could quickly tailspin into some not real detailed policy discussions, right? Where, I forget which Republican debate it was, where it essentially came down to name-calling. I think there's a concern there because, you have two very different personalities. You have two people who have become very personal in their attacks against one another, and you lose a lot of substance there. And I think that's going to be the concern going forward, is that there's going to be absolutely no substance when it gets to be a general election matchup between Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton.
Hmm. So, Kedren, what does Cruz need to do well in a contested convention at this point? If it looks like that's where we're going forward, if Trump doesn't take Indiana and Kentucky, what would Cruz need to do well in that convention?
Well, I mean, he's already doing what he needed to do well, which is to maximize his knowledge of and then use of the rules that exist in the states for selecting delegates, so that a number of the people that show up there might be bound to vote for a certain candidate, but then on second vote, something like 31 states, if no candidate gets a majority on the first vote, those delegates from those 31 states can essentially vote their conscience. And you've seen Cruz rack up victory after victory, and not just in strong fashion, but resounding fashion, almost unilaterally in some of these states, taking all of the delegate bundles. So he's already doing what he needs to do. I think in terms of the perception of his strength as a candidate, these races really showed some holes in his appeal to even within his own party. You look at those five races last night, Ted Cruz actually came in third in four out of those five northeastern states to John Kasich. So we're showing that there's a factional appeal to Ted Cruz among the most conservative Republicans, but he's not someone who seems to be able to unite Republicans across the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. And I mentioned before that Ted Cruz and John Kasich, kind of ahead of last night's primaries, they said they were going to kind of divide and conquer and try to take delegates away from Trump rather than just promote themselves. What does it say that didn't really end up working for them?
I'd say it points to the fact that both of these are candidates that are niche candidates within their own party. If you look at Cruz, he represents essentially the most conservative element of the GOP. If you look at Kasich, maybe 20 years ago he didn't, but today Kasich represents essentially the moderate to conservative wing of the GOP. And so both of them, that's what's so interesting about this deal, is essentially you're asking voters in these different states where they made an alliance to essentially withdraw and help each other out and help the other person get their voters out. You're asking those voters to vote for someone who probably is the least likely person that they might go for in an open Republican nomination. That's why the deal's tenuous. That's why I think it may not work, not just because not all voters are strategic, but also because the appeal of Cruz and Kasich, I think, is relatively limited within their own party base.
You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk. Email us at river2river@iowapublicradio.org. I'm talking politics today with political analyst Kedren Bardwell of Simpson College and Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Again, that number to call is 866-780-9100. We're going to be back after a few minutes of break. I'm Emily Woodbury. This is River to River from Iowa Public Radio. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury in for Ben Kiefer. It's Politics Day today, and with me are political analyst Kedren Bardwell of Simpson College and Chris Larimer with the University of Northern Iowa. We're talking about the results of yesterday's primaries, the looming adjournment of the Iowa legislature coming up, and looking ahead to local Iowa elections come November. What issue means the most to you leading up to the local and national elections in November? You can join our conversation by calling 866-780-9100 or tweet us at IPR Talk. Tom is calling in from Sioux City. Hello, Tom.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hello. Hello. What's your comment?
I just wanted to see if either one of the panel members would agree with the assessment that the Republicans are probably going to pivot to the social issues, specifically making it about the Supreme Court. I could see a situation very easily where if Hillary thinks she's got it locked up, the vote's going to be suppressed, and that puts Florida and possibly Virginia in play if they convince everybody that they're going to do away with the Second Amendment. And, well, that's just the start. It's about the Supreme Court, stupid. And I just wanted to find out what they thought about that.
All right. Thanks for your call, Tom. So, you know, Kedren, let's start with you. We have an opening on the Supreme Court where a lot of social issues are decided. Is this opening going to kind of make us look at some social issues?
I think that entirely depends on the candidate. I mean, the presidential candidate is essentially the representative of their party for the year that they're running, and they set the agenda. I think Ted Cruz has already signaled that these issues related to the gay marriage decision, religious liberty, and other social issues are going to be at the top of his agenda. And talking about the Supreme Court, as someone who's argued before the Supreme Court several times, is definitely something that he's brought into the mix. Now, if Trump wins the nomination, I actually think you're going to hear relatively little about social issues, maybe other than gun control. If you think of that as a social issue, he has talked about defending the Second Amendment. But other than that, I think Trump's wheelhouse is jobs, 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 change to Washington, you know, bring in someone who's outside of politics to clean things up. And he's a little more neutral to sometimes uncomfortable, I think, talking about some of the issues that someone like Ted Cruz is more comfortable talking about.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's move forward to next Tuesday, May 3rd. We have Indiana's primary. Are social issues going to be a big determinant of how primary voters vote on Tuesday?
Well, I think Indiana is an interesting hybrid. If you look at it in the surrounding states, if you look at the fact that it has some major cities but also some very rural areas, the fact that Trump did very well in Illinois but Cruz did well in Wisconsin, but yet Kasich won Ohio, it's a really nice test case. We've also got a full week where we can just focus on Indiana, and so the turnout should be relatively high. And so although it's not necessarily a bellwether anymore in national general elections, it will be a bellwether, I think, for where this race is going next, because each of the candidates has a play there, and at least theoretically before this Cruz-Kasich deal would have an argument to say that they were pretty well positioned geographically to do well.
Well, it's interesting that you say that each of the candidates could possibly do well there, because Kasich's team sent out a note that set after yesterday's primary saying basically they're bypassing Indiana and focusing their efforts west. Chris, do you think this was a smart move on Kasich's team's part?
Well, I think they're struggling to get any sort of momentum. I mean, he's still a candidate in that campaign. It's still a campaign that has only won one of the 41 states to this point. And so they are, you know, their goal is obviously to get it to the convention and just stay as relevant as possible, whether that's talking about changing strategy, you know, going to different states. You know, they're just trying to stay in the conversation. I mean, for a candidate who's still in the race but trails someone who is not in the race in Marco Rubio, you know, they're trying to do whatever they can to appeal to any sort of block of voters that might capture national media attention. I mean, because at this point, there is no other reason for Kasich really to be in the race unless he's looking at a second or third ballot at the convention, which is increasingly unlikely. Mm-hmm. So, it's an interesting strategy. I'm not sure that they can really point to anything substantive that's coming from it.
There's no party registration in Indiana, unlike yesterday's primaries, a lot of closed primaries. You had to be Democrat or Republican. You had to be registered. But is there going to be a lot of impact here? What do we know about how many independents are in Indiana?
I don't know a lot about the independents that are in Indiana. You know, that if Kasich's not competing there, there isn't a window there for him to appeal to independents. I mean, they may just not represent a large proportion of it. I just don't know enough about the electorate in Indiana. But again, as Kendrin said, this is a good test case. In the end, it may not matter much. A lot of people keep talking about Indiana as sort of this, you know, race-changing state, and I simply don't see that. You know, in terms of the number of delegates, where you're talking about 57 delegates, if Cruz wins, you know, maybe that stops Trump a little bit, or certainly would slow him down in terms of that race to get to 1,237 delegates. But 57 delegates after Trump is ahead of Cruz by 400-plus delegates is really not changing a lot. And so it would take a significant victory there by Cruz, where he just blows Trump out of the water by 10-plus points. And realistically, I don't see that happening. So, I think all this focus on Indiana is to try to, you know, get that horse race mentality going again, where I just don't know if it's that much of a race anymore.
Hmm. Nick is calling in from Des Moines. Good afternoon, Nick.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
My question is regarding Ted Cruz's surprise major announcement that's going to be coming within the next couple of hours. If that surprise announcement is that he adds a vice presidential pick, how much would that alter the state of the race right now?
Oh, Kedrin, do you want to take that question?
Wow, yeah. Talk about putting the cart before the horse here. I don't think it's likely that, although people have discussed it, I don't think it's likely that he's going to announce any kind of VP arrangement. My understanding is they just started vetting possible VP candidates a few weeks ago, and that's a pretty long process to do that. I think the problem with even doing something like that is it just plays into Trump's narrative, and Trump would say, you know, look how weak he is. He can't even run on his own. He has to tag team against me and have two against one. You know, look how weak he is. He needs to do anything he can. People don't normally pick their VPs this early. He needs to do anything he can just to stop me. And so Trump has had this ability to play most of these strategic moves by people like Cruz and other candidates in this race, really to his advantage in some interesting ways.
Well, thanks
Sorry.
Oh, go ahead, Chris.
I was going to say, and I did see on Twitter and now Politico is talking about, you know, Cruz is going to have this major announcement at 4 o'clock today, and it's all the speculation is about Carly Fiorina as the potential running mate. And I would agree with Kendra. I mean, you know, it's way too early to really think about this, but I don't know that if it is Carly Fiorina, how does that really change the race? I mean, this is on the Monkey Cage blog on the Washington Post, which political scientists use to kind of talk about some of the research they're doing. You know, there's been a little bit of back and forth about the effect of VP candidates. On one hand, you have a couple of political scientists saying that the effect there is marginal. On the other hand, it may be 3 or 4 percentage points in a candidate's home state. Well, if we're talking about Carly Fiorina in California, a state that Democrats have won by 20-plus percentage points the last two presidential cycles, you know, I don't know that Carly Fiorina really changes anything in the race and really broadens the appeal of a Ted Cruz campaign.
Well, we have another hypothetical question on this point. Matthew emailed in that if Trump doesn't win on the first round of convention voting, might Cruz offer the VP slot to Kasich or Rubio in exchange for the latter's delegates? What do you think about that, Kedrin?
Boy, that's an interesting one. I think, first of all, John Kasich has said he doesn't want to be second fiddle to anybody, and I think given the fact that he's now a governor, I just don't think it's likely that he would take that spot. I think it's more likely that someone like Rubio might be a part of that kind of deal. It's increasingly likely that we may not even get there. I think Chris was talking about Indiana before, and I think it's an important race in the sense that I think Cruz needs to stop the bleeding. He needs to show that the momentum has not swung fully in Trump's direction. I think one of the things that I was trying to think about last night was, how do we explain the size of these Trump wins in these northeastern states? People were expecting he might reach 50%. He won 64% in Rhode Island, 61% in Delaware, almost 60% in Pennsylvania. I think there's a sense among the Stop Trump and Never Trump forces that this is getting out of hand and that, you know, all may be lost. But when that inevitability effect comes in, you could really discourage the turnout among the Stop Trump supporters. And so I think Indiana becomes crucial in terms of just stopping the bleeding. And so we'll see what happens if we get to convention, but I don't know that we'll even get there.
It's Politics Day on River to River. We have about 10 minutes left in the show. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or email us at rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. I want to move on to a more local race, the race between incumbent U.S. Representative Steve King and his challenger, State Senator Rick Bertrand. This week, Governor Branstad said he won't endorse any candidate in the primary race, specifically this race, but he said it a little bit more generally, too, that he's made this statement that endorsements don't really mean much. Chris, do you agree? Do you think an endorsement from our governor has an impact?
Well, it's hard to measure because our governors have been pretty reluctant to endorse. There's always been speculation about who our governor was going to endorse in the lead-up to the Iowa caucuses over the years, but our governors have been pretty reluctant to do that. I think the closest we came was when First Lady Kristi Vilsack endorsed John Kerry prior to the 2004 caucuses. But in general, the research on, something like gubernatorial endorsements is generally pretty weak. You don't see a big uptick in vote share for the candidate that the governor endorses, at least in terms of the general election. So, the fact that the effect as it's been measured in political science is pretty marginal, and that Governor Branstad and Iowa governors generally have been pretty reluctant to endorse. It's not particularly surprising that he's not jumping into this in endorsing anyone in this particular race. Now, some people may try to read more into it because, Steve King was endorsed Ted Cruz, who then Governor Branstad said that Ted Cruz needs to be defeated given his stance on ethanol. I don't know. I don't see that. I think it's just more that Governor Branstad generally just doesn't endorse candidates.
Mm-hmm. Well, the primary for this race is June 7th. Kedron, do you have a grasp on what voters in Northwest Iowa are thinking about ahead of this primary?
Yeah, I think this is a case where when you have an incumbent who's been in office in Congress so long, and Steve King has developed a national reputation. Now, whether or not you like the exposure that he brings back to Iowa, certainly many of the more conservative voters in Northwest Iowa like it. And so it's really incumbent on State Representative State Senator Bertrand to justify why now and why knock King out of there. If you've got somebody who's been in Congress for a while, who knows the ropes, do you have to have a justification as a challenger for running? Now, Bertrand says that King has just been there too long and has become a creature of Washington. I don't know that most people in Western and Northwestern Iowa think of Steve King as a creature of Washington. If anything, he gives Washington fits. So I think maybe Bertrand needs to come up with a little bit stronger and more maybe issue-focused justification for why King should be primaried in his own party.
I'd like to have you both comment on an outside force that's trying to get into this year's congressional elections. Tom Steyer, he's a billionaire environmentalist. He spent millions to help elect Democrats in 2014. And this week, his group Next Gen Climate launched a $25 million campaign to drive the youth vote in this year's presidential and congressional elections. Chris, do you think this is going to be effective in getting more young people involved in the process, especially in the congressional campaigns?
Well, this was a story that really interested me because my research deals with voter turnout and get out the vote techniques. I really want to know more about what he's doing because, as I understand it, they're targeting battleground states, and Iowa is one of these states that some of that $25 million is going to be in which it's going to be spent. It's going to depend on the technique. If this is a case where it's just mailers and robocalls, we know those things are generally ineffective, get-out-the-vote techniques. But if it's a more personalized message, if it's, more social media technology, text messaging, YouTube, Instagram, whatever technique they decide to use, that might appeal to a younger block of voters. But there's a great opportunity there for research. I don't know that they'll necessarily open it up for that, but to try out different techniques for targeting younger voters. I mean, we all know that's the voting, or that's the portion of the electorate that's the most difficult generally to mobilize, is that 18 to 24 year old group. It'll be interesting to see what techniques they employ to try to get that younger generation out to vote. Because right now, as Kendrin started off the hour talking about, the enthusiasm simply isn't there this time around. It's not 2008. 2016 is very different, and I imagine it's probably similar for Kendrin. You just don't see the enthusiasm on college campuses that you saw in 2008. So I want to know more about, what are the techniques that that group is actually going to use for targeting that younger group of voters.
Interesting. Well, I can speak from my own experience. I'm a cord cutter. I don't have cable, and I've been seeing a lot of next-gen climate ads on YouTube and you know, online streaming websites. So there's that, at least an anecdotal experience. Do you think that rhetoric on climate change is really an effective starting point? Do you think that's an issue that millennial voters are most concerned about?
Well, I don't know if they're most concerned about it, but I think they're more concerned about it than other other age groups or age brackets. You know, we see more and more that the younger population, college population, is they may lean slightly liberal, but there's also a pretty strong libertarian streak there as well. And an issue like climate change seems to be somewhat popular with that younger demographic.
Kedron, what do you think as far as that, you know, Chris mentioned libertarian, but what about young GOP voters? They are there.
Yeah, I'll tell a couple anecdotes about this effort to get climate change out there as an issue that motivates younger voters. I think particularly if you have Clinton running against either Trump or Cruz, and if you look at just the anecdotal evidence here, but then also some polling data, Cruz and Trump are not the candidates that are going to get Republican, especially college-educated Republican voters, excited about voting Republican. And there are really two issues that I've seen the last few years really be kind of cross-cutting within the young Republican crowd. That is, there are issues where they would actually prefer almost the Democratic position to the Republican position, and those are environmental issues and climate change, and then gay rights and gay marriage. And so I think it is a smart thing for these independent interest groups to do, to try to focus on those issues where there are those conflicting feelings among some younger Republican voters about whether their party is truly representing them, or are they representing someone who's a 65-year-old white male on these issues where they have some conflict or some difference with their party.
I'd like to narrow it down a little bit more before the end of the hour. We have a few minutes left. The Iowa legislature is expected to adjourn soon. Some are saying in the next few days. And lawmakers have not yet settled on the budget, which is part of what's holding things up. And notably, Republicans are trying to push through a budget that would defund Planned Parenthood in Iowa.
I have made a recommendation that is consistent with what the House Republicans have been working on for the last couple of years. And the idea is to provide family planning money in a way that doesn't fund abortion providers.
So that was Governor Branstad talking about the measure to defund Planned Parenthood. And specifically, this measure has been added to a human services budget bill. Chris, how are Iowa's Democratic senators going to handle this?
Well, I think, you know, they're going to push back pretty hard on it. And I think they've already started to do that, to talk about it more in terms of providing services that Planned Parenthood doesn't just provide abortion services. It provides a number of other services that are important to women. And so, you know, I think there's going to be some pretty serious pushback by Democrats on this issue, and I think they're already starting to do that.
Mm-hmm. The governor said that the idea with this amendment is to provide family planning money in a way that doesn't fund abortion providers. Do the actions of the governor and the Iowa House of Representatives support this claim that they want to provide family planning money? Do you see that anywhere in the budget?
I haven't looked at seen the details of the budget that looked at them that closely to know you know, if how that statement fares.
Sure. Well, one other big issue toward the end of this year's session is water quality. And, you know, the rumor is that nothing's going to be decided on this session. Why does it seem that all the big issues are kind of rushed on towards the end of the session? Last year it was education. This year it's water quality and funding of Planned Parenthood. Why does this all seem to come up right towards the end?
Well, I think it just speaks to that generally state legislatures are becoming more partisan, and you're seeing, you know, more money flowing into obviously federal races, but it's also trickling down to state races. And you see trends in state legislatures where they're becoming more partisan, that it's becoming harder to adjourn. You're seeing more party line votes. You're seeing fewer bills being passed. And that's happening in Iowa, too, where it's starting to you know, mirror to some extent, not at all close to what it is at the federal level, but you just see it's a more partisan atmosphere in state politics, and so it makes it harder to get things done. Campaigns are lasting longer, and so state legislators are most likely more concerned with campaigns, more concerned about how they're voting on particular issues, because they know that those are going to be issues for their next primary campaign or their next general election campaign. And I was one of them who thought that maybe this year, because it's an election year, they might try to be able to, they might get done on time on April 19th, the 100th day of the session, to focus on the general election campaigns. But I think you're just seeing a more partisan atmosphere, and it's not just Iowa. It's other states where this is happening.
You know, we only have a few seconds left, but Chris, in a nutshell, do you see the Iowa State Senate as a battleground chamber in the November election?
It's been a battleground chamber since 2011, and we see political scientists continuing to rank it as one of these chambers that's going to flip, but it also seems to be immune to national politics, where you don't see it losing, Democrats or Republicans losing seats in years in which you might expect them to. So I think it's still up in the air whether or not it'll flip.
Chris Larimer, he's a political analyst with the University of Northern Iowa. Thanks for joining me today, Chris.
Thanks, Emily.
And Kedron Bardwell, he's an associate professor of political science at Simpson College. Thanks for joining me, too.
Thank you.
River to River is produced by Lindsay Moon and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Emily Woodbury. Thank you for joining us.